Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Happy birthday, Gary.
Thank you, Guy. It's not exactly my perfect spot for a birthday, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
I would dispute that, because it turns out that we are steeped in musical history where we are. It's a museum centre. It's the home of the Woody Guthrie Collection, the Bob Dylan Museum. We're going to Church Studios later. It's just no pleasing some people.
No, I think I'd rather be at home with my family. But you're right. I went to the Woody Guthrie.
No, people mustn't think we have any life other than music, Gary.
Yes. But I went to the Woody Guthrie Centre yesterday, which has got lots and lots of his notebooks and his entire works are all there, and his incredible paintings. I didn't realise Woody Guthrie was such a great artist.
I would pay whatever for one of his paintings. They actually move me as much as his writing, frankly.
Yeah, and an incredible story. You know, they talk a lot about who his influences would have been, and obviously we all know how Billy Bragg has spoken a lot about Woody Guthrie and the protest songs and Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan. But there's elements of what he was doing which would have led into, I'm thinking of sort of jug band and skiffle and the Quarrymen, and inevitably the Beatles.
Yes,
of course. It links together.
Well, also, Joe Strummer looked a bit like him.
He did. Yeah, you're right.
And that's very similar. I can imagine. I think Joe probably got a lot from, you know, him, his whole shtick.
Well, writing on his guitar, you know, which is obviously what Woody did. This
machine kills fascists.
Brilliant. And then I went pop next door and saw the Bob Dylan. We go to these things separately because I quite like to walk around on my own.
Because you hate me. No, but we do go separately. Also, I wasn't feeling that well. So I went, you know what? After the Woody Guthrie, I thought, mate, if it's Dylan next door, your head's full. Go back tomorrow.
You're going today.
I'm going today is what I mean. Yeah, I just thought, you know.
Well, I went yesterday, and I tell you what's extraordinary, because, you know, Dylan had nothing to do with Tulsa, but he wanted to be next door to Woody Guthrie. He sold his works to Tulsa, to this one guy who's collected it all. He's called Kaiser. That's his surname, Mr. Kaiser. He's the one who's made this Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan museums here in Tulsa. And what the thing that really took me by surprise is they've got some of Bob Dylan's notebooks and his lyric books, and it's tiny, weeny fairy writing that he writes in. I mean, it's the smallest writing you can imagine. And it's quite sweet, but it's unreadable to the human eye.
I found that in the Woody Guthrie Museum. The handwritten stuff is just, it's exhausting.
Yeah, and of course this is the trouble now, because people write everything on computers.
Exactly, you know, exactly. We're not accustomed to handwriting, and plus, you know, we're getting on.
It's not really worth selling. Anyway, to our guest today, who's a little bit of a sidestep for us, but not entirely. It seems it on the face of it that Paddy Considine is an actor. And Guy and I are obsessed with Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon that is currently running, where Paddy plays.
And we're assuming,
King
and we're Viserys. Kind of assuming with the sort of audience we have that probably quite a lot of you are too.
Well, yeah, I think certainly, if you're into prog, you're probably into Game of Thrones.
Because I've got to say, the thing that stops me watching Game of Thrones for years, right? I resisted, was the thing that kept me away from and still does from a lot of prog, which is dragons and capes don't do it for me. But then as soon as you start, it's irresistible, isn't it?
It's absolutely irresistible. But what's incredible is his performance.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Is astonishing. There will be spoilers. To spoiler alerts, up to episode 8 of this first season, where Paddy sort of stars. But the other reason for getting Paddy on is not only is he a fan of Raconteurs, but he has done a lot of music. He's got a fantastic band called Riding the Low.
Who I've seen.
Latest album. You've seen?
We'll get to that. I've seen only a bit, but I have, yeah. But
The fantastic new album called The Death of Gobshite Rambo. And the music is brilliant.
They're really good. All three albums are really, really good, I've got to say.
Yeah, and he's sort of been involved in a lot of music. You know, he played Rob Gretton, Joy Division's manager and 24 Hour Party People. Frank Thorogood, the man who may have murdered Brian Jones in the Stephen Woolley film Stoned. And he's written and starred in an Arctic Monkeys video, Coldplay video. I mean, yeah, music is also part of his life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
How are we doing?
Oh, Paddy.
Gary,
what
Guy,
an intro. What an intro. Fantastic. Just for our listeners, right? Literally, the screen came on and he whipped off his shades. That was, right. That was magnificent.
Yeah. Paddy, you look much better than when I last saw you, which was last night watching episode 8.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty bad.
House of the Dragons. I'm thinking that in House of the Dragon, they just had to lose you at that final point because they'd run out of makeup.
I think so, yeah. That took up most of the budget, just getting me to look so emaciated. But yeah, that was some gig. That was some hours in the makeup chair and a bit of VFX and things like that. Yeah, but it was pretty sort of like, my wife showed me the last image and it was just like, it just shocked me how kind of much I looked like my dad who died, you know, of cancer. And when I saw the final thing, my wife called me and she goes, you just got to see the end bit when before you die. And it was just a massive shock because I looked the image of my dad. It wasn't just like, oh, it reminded me of my dad. I looked the image of him when he went in the last few days of his life. So I was just like, oh, God, that's a bit close to the bone. But there you go.
But, Paddy, it was absolutely an incredible performance all the way through.
All the way through, man. It's fantastic. We've been wrapped, I tell you.
We'll go on to that later. But I think we wanted to sort of, being the Rock on Tours, we wanted to let our audience know, and we have spoken about it in the intro, about you with your band and you as a musician.
Who I've seen, but not properly, Paddy. I found two tenuous links between you and me, right?
I said to my guitarist the other day, Chris, I said, this will be the first Rock on Tours where Guy Pratt won't be able to say, I've worked with them, or I've got some kind of link.
I have accompanied you on the bass, but not while you were singing, while you were acting. I played bass on the score of the movie Blitz.
Oh, my God. There you go. There you go.
Do you know what? It's so fucking boring, Paddy. I'm so sick of it by now, right? What was the second connection?
The second connection was that I saw you said I was at Bingley Weekender.
No way.
But I couldn't see you because I saw you soundcheck and I saw the end of your set because you were on at exactly the same time as my son's duo, Outline, who I was tour managing and production managing and everything on the Sunday morning, which is why I was there.
Oh, well, brilliant.
I had no idea.
Oh, it'd have been great to have met you.
Oh, it would have been fantastic. I know, but there you go.
So, Paddy, Riding the Low, we absolutely love these records. We really do.
Oh, thank you.
I've got to say, because this was meant to happen. Sorry, Gary. This was meant to happen a couple of weeks ago, right? This thing. And so my research was, I was listening to these albums walking around Chicago at night. Mad, bustling Chicago. And it just worked, you know.
Oh, that's brilliant. I'm absolutely blown away, really. I know you guys are very researched, but part of my trepidation of doing this was I love this show. I listen to Noddy Holder and David Coverdale, and there's been so many great apps, and they've got these great stories about their life in music, and that's what I love about it. And I'm like going, what the hell have I got to say? I don't have any anecdotes. Or I'm like talking myself out of doing it. And the only reason, my wife said to me, like, well, Gary's asked you to do it. And I was like, well, yeah, I know, but I don't really have a rock and roll history, and no one's brought loads of our records. And, you know, what do they want to talk to me for? I'm just an actor. And she went, Gary's an actor? And I went, oh, okay, fair enough, then we'll do it.
but this is the thing, though, Paddy, you know, and which leads to the question is when you're up on stage with Riding the Low as the lead singer, are you still an actor? Or is that you? Because I know in the new album, you know, if you look at the credits, you're Gobshite Rambo.
Yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, the new album is called The Death of Gobshite Rambo. But is that your character? And is that what you hide behind? Is that the only way you can present yourself? Because you've not been Gobshite Rambo on earlier albums, have you?
No, that's something that developed. And it's a bit of an in-joke in the band, actually. It goes back to years ago when, I used to get quite drunk when we played. And I, you know, used to kind of gob off a bit, mouth off a little bit. And I thought I was being funny, but it actually came off as really aggressive and not particularly nice. So I was up there thinking I was having a laugh. And that's not the way that it was really going down. So I kind of sobered up out of it, really. But Gobshite Rambo became just this sort of generic character in a way. And partly nicknamed after my father, who the title track is about. Funny enough, it's about the day that he died, that particular song.
Oh, wow.
And watching everybody's reactions to his death and his passing.
Did you write that?
Weird...
Sorry, Seven, did you write that before you did that scene or had seen that scene?
Oh, yeah. I'd written that song a few years ago. It's on the album, okay. Yeah. But it's funny because it's quite strange what's going on at the minute, because I feel a lot of things are lining up. A lot of my work over the years has been about this sort of subject matter, you know, of life and mortality and you know, watching loved ones around you pass and where they go to and things like that. And, you know, so to see that in House of the Dragon the other night and part of the song, I think what I'm trying to say is a lot of the song's writing is kind of about that scene, I suppose. But I was very much observing my family and watching their reactions to my dad dying and looking at him in the room like a filmmaker would. I remember having a bizarre thought going, how would I shoot this if I was a director? Well, I'd start on my sister weird thing's going through my head. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, it must just be your coping mechanism. But that's the great thing to me about songwriting. And that's why I started becoming I became a songwriter, was because I was able to put these thoughts and things into songs, and it felt a lot easier than making films about them.
But is that thing that you're just saying about your watching your dad dying and the death of Viserys and this song? Is this the sort of rage against the light, isn't it? That you as an actor would tune into. But it's also to do with reaching a certain age when an awareness of your own mortality.
Yeah.
And watching, you know, because I've watched. I mean, I watched both of my parents die, you know, and it's an extremely painful, difficult thing, but it's just, we know we all have to go into that. But but as an artist, you put that into your work.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I think I've done all along, in the best acting roles and in the best songs that we've written. That's kind of what I've done. And that's been an odd journey for me in terms of the reception to Riding the Low and the kind of suspicion around it, because I've always been, I've had no shame in calling myself an artist, because I understand that gave me a title and it gave me something that I could give myself a little bit of meaning by calling myself that. And I think that all I've ever really done through the best acting work and through the songs is try to just make some kind of sense of this existence and just try to tell stories about it.
There's the obvious ones of people like Bowie who construct characters or whatever. But I don't know, if you've seen Springsteen on Broadway, it's like within the first 5 minutes, he's revealed that everything is a complete construct. You know, he wrote Born to Run, he lives 5 minutes from where he grew up. And his entire, this person who his audience view as the ultimate in kind of truth and integrity, but is basically an idealized construct of his father. It's a character.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's probably what I created as well. Yeah. So when you ask Gary about is it Paddy or is it a performance? It's definitely a character, but the voice coming through it all and in the writing is definitely Paddy. So even up on the stage, it's a bit of both. I when I go on stage, we wear paint now and things like that, and it just gives me, it makes me feel a bit braver going up there and standing.
You look pretty scary, I've got to say.
Yeah. Well, at some point, you know, there's blood now and, you know, get out a baseball bat for one of the songs he'd, and, you know, there's more sort of characterizations coming into the performances now as we're growing as a band.
What it reminds me of a bit is Alex Harvey. Is that someone that you know?
Yeah, yeah, the Alex Harvey band, yeah. And funnily enough, I keep a separate Instagram account, and it's a scrapbook of imagery, and Alex Harvey's in there. You know, that, yeah. And there's that great performance of him. I don't know what festival it's at, but it's somewhere in Europe. And he's on stage and he's kind of got these tights over his head and things like that. And he puts them in his mouth and then he's looking out at the audience in this really sort of bizarre, intimidating way. And they're just stone silent. And I'm like, wow, it's just mind blowing to see that.
No, I saw him play. I mean, he has that famous song, Let Me Put My Hands On You, you know,
yeah.
I think is the big scream. And I saw him at Charlton supporting The Who when I was 15.
Wow.
With my brother, who was 13, and we were utterly transfixed by it.
Well, I think some of that feels quite lost in performance at the minute. You know, I feel like I've seen a lot of music at the minute, and I want to see something more. I want to see the soul. And, you know, just a few weeks ago, I saw Mark Rylance in Jerusalem, and I walked out of the theatre shaking. And I, when I walked out, I thought, I want to bring that to a gig, to a show. I want to bring elements of that to a music gig so that people walk out and go, oh, shit.
That's actually what we went for. I mean, the whole thing was, you know, it used to be, especially about the Who are the best example, where it was scary, where, you know, Pete would be so confrontational with the audience. You know, there's a guitar up here if anyone, little git wants to take it. And there was... That, do you know what I mean? That was that was part of what you went for. You wanted to be scared.
For the danger of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
But I think that's it. I think that, and I think a truly great performance is when an artist first comes on, that they are above the audience. They are greater, more powerful, more intimidating than the audience. And this is what the audience kind of wants, what we all want. By the end of the show, you are equals.
Yeah.
If you could somehow make that happen in the arc, you know, of your performance over an hour or hour and a half, whatever it is, that's something really superb to achieve.
I'll tell you who has got it these days, who I find his shows actually really quite terrifying, is Nick Cave, where he is literally a shaman, you know, and it's the way he cultivates. Where it's, I went to a show of his in Milan, and you literally got the feeling if he said to that audience, go and storm the TV station, they would.
they'd do it, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's something running through Nick Cave that's, you know, it's...
It's amazing, yeah. Amazing.
It's very special. What you said, though, Gary, about the audience thing as well, and it's definitely a sense of that. You've got to go in with that. And Jez Butterworth says that, you know, you go into a theatre and by each act, you know, the objective is, so you're in a room for 1,000 people, then in act two, it shrinks down to half of that. And by the end of the play, it's shrunk down to just you. And it feels so intimate that there could practically be just a handful of people in there. And I think that's a really, really powerful thing, you know, to go in with, is that air of superiority to begin with, in a way, and then just to bring everybody closer to you by the end.
I saw you in Jez's play, The Ferryman, which is obviously set during the Troubles in Ireland. And you went to Broadway with that, didn't you?
Yeah,
Paddy.
Yeah, did 5 months on Broadway with it, which was never in my plans. So I was like, what am I doing on Broadway? This wasn't supposed to happen, but it was the best experience. And with all the time you get in theatre as well, I just kept writing songs. So I just wrote, I don't know, about 3 albums worth of ideas out there. And, you know, it was a really great time to do that. A lot of songs reappeared on Gobshite Rambo as well.
So let's talk about Riding the Low and how that came about. Because obviously you've been in bands from early on. Wasn't your first band with Shane Meadows?
Yeah, there was Shane. I mean, we were just kicking around at college. And I think the idea of having a band was, let's form a band And it was Shane's idea at the time. Let's form a band and, you know, we can get look cool and get girls interested in us. I think it was a very, you know.
I love the idea that kind of acting and directing isn't going to do that. It's still music.
Yeah, you know? Let's get into music and do it. But I'd tinkered in bands since I was like 15. I'd met my lifelong friend, Rich Eaton, who plays bass in Riding the Low. He's the musician I've worked with the longest. And his next door neighbour was a kid called Nick Hemming, who went on to form a band called the Leisure Society, who ended up
getting... Yeah, I've seen them play.
Yeah, they're great, and he's such a talented guy. But we were all
John
there.
Sim.
Yeah,
John Sim took
vids,
me to see
right?
them play.
Yeah.
So yeah, we went to see them at that church in Islington, and I
Union
thought they
Chapel.
Were absolutely beautiful.
Union Chapel, yeah,
Union
that's
Chapel.
It. Yeah.
The Leisure Society. If no one's ever heard the Leisure Society, check them out. We should get Nick on, actually.
Yeah, Nick's sorry, great. Go on. Nick's great. And also, I used one of Nick's songs in Tyrannosaur, the first film I wrote and directed. I used this song, We Were Wasted, on it.
Which is an amazing, incredibly powerful film. Got to say.
Yeah, well, thank
we'll
you.
Get up. We'll get on to that.
We'll get right. there.
Carry on.
But no, Nick, so you got Nick living next door and there's Rich and I turn up and we're knocking about. Rich's dad had all this
Where
old
is this? Whereabouts is this?
In Burton-on-Trent, in a little estate called Winsell in Burton-on-Trent. And Richard's dad had loads of this like old recording equipment from the BBC that he'd somehow got his hands on. So we used to play around with it and record skits and, you know, mess a band, things like that. And then we went to college and that's when we met Shane and formed a band. And it was literally sitting around a table and Shane went, let's have a band. I'll be the singer, of course. And then it was like, well, Rich will play the bass and our friend Simon will play guitar. What are you going to do? And I went, oh, I guess I'll play the drums. And then the next day, the very next day, this is not BS, a drum kit turned up at the college and somebody else didn't want it. And they said, does the college want it? So off we went, you know, and we became the college band. But that was kind of fun. It was just a load of fun, and I enjoyed doing it. And then I went to Brighton, and that was in the 90s, so we formed a college Britpop band, which was really good fun. But I never saw a career or anything in it, and I never wrote a song. It was bizarrely for me, when I was about 29, my wife one Christmas gave me an acoustic guitar, and I said, oh, thank you, that's great. In my mind thinking, what the hell have you brought me a guitar for? And I'm like, it's just going to sit in the corner. I don't play guitar. I was playing on the drums. And that morning, I just sat there and tinkered and wrote two songs. And they were okay, you know. But the big surprise was, where have these things come from? You know, I never had any aspirations to be a songwriter. So where have they come from? And then I just got addicted to it, and that was it. And then I wrote songs on my own, and Nick would help me out and record with me, and Richard play on them. And I was very much like alone doing this. And I thought, you know what? I've got a few songs I've written. I'm going to get a bunch of guys in the room, get them to learn them, and then I can record them. And then when I'm kind of around this age, and my kids are grown up, I can say, hey, your dad was in a band, you know? Have a listen to this. And that was the main reason. It wasn't until I got in a room with the other guys and they actually played the songs fully live that I went, oh, shit. This other power came out of it. And I went, oh, wow. And the potential, I just saw the potential for it. And I think 6 weeks later, Riding the Low, we were playing their first gig in Burton-on-Trent at Bar 15.
And what when you said you were at college with Shane and you got those bands together, what were you studying to be an actor at that point?
Yeah, I left school at, you know, 16, was it? And then went to college there and it was a little sort of college annex in Winsell. The building don't exist anymore. And I only lasted a year. I left after a year. I just didn't like it. I didn't feel like I was being taught anything. And I just sort of turned around and went, you know what? If this is what acting's about, then I'm not interested. And I gave up any aspirations to be an actor. It just didn't interest me at all. I didn't feel like I'd learnt anything. I wasn't learning anything and I wasn't enjoying the course. So I was on the dole for a year. You know, I put about 3 stone on. I met my wife when I was 18 and kind of had a mini breakdown and ended up like Brian Wilson for a few months and all that, just sitting on benches in Burton-on-Trent thinking, what am I going to do with my life?
Wow.
And then wow. I went back to college that summer, but I did not to do performing arts. I did photography and film and I went to Brighton University. Yeah. Well, eventually I went to Brighton University and did my degree in editorial photography, which I loved, which I absolutely loved my time in Brighton. It was a great time. It was the 90s.
It's a great town, man. But it's where I live. So.
Is it really? Yeah.
Yeah.
The music was fantastic. You know, we were young. We had no responsibilities. And the films were great. Music was great. We had our own little band. And it was all fun, really. But.
And what music were you into when you were younger?
When I was really young.
What inspired you?
Well, I lived in a house full of people, well, you know, my parents and my sisters, and it was so massively eclectic. I mean, it was just whatever pop music was going around, we played it and we loved it. It would range from, I don't know, we could be listening to a Brendan Shine record, and then we were listening to ELO, then David Bowie, then The Sparks, and... So music was music to me. I never sort of discriminated with it. I thought all music was great, and I never subscribed to any sort of particular genre. Even growing up in my teens, I adored what was perceived as pop music, which we now look back as great music, like Spandau Ballet. You know, those songs were just great. You know, they become a part of your life.
Really, I'll take that, Paddy. Thank
they
you.
They do, and I listened to all of those bands. You know, I'd had no discrimination, but at the same time, I was listening to The Jam, I was listening to The Specials, and I was listening to The Sex Pistols. And so that was the early years. You know, there was such a massive mix of things. I just loved great songs. But the big moment for me was when I was a little kid and I saw Adam and the Ants on Top of the Pops doing Dog Eat Dog, I think it was. And that was the light bulb moment of like, whoa. Like
that's where the stripe on your face comes from, isn't it?
Yes, because Paddy has this black stripe across his eyes when he performs as in Riding Low.
Well, some of our songs have a bit of a sort of a Western kind of theme, and there's a song called
Lone
Tommy
Ranger,
York.
Isn't it? Yeah,
yeah. So it comes out of the Lone Ranger, but it's definitely born from Adamant, no doubt about it. But that was the moment, and that's it. I want to be a pop star. I want to be Adamant. So I got my sisters to put bows in my hair and, you know, put on the makeup. And, you know, I walked around my neighbourhood and nearly got beat up by a couple of guys because I was, you know, I had lipstick
how,
on
how
and bows
you?
In
how
my hair.
How old were you?
Well, I would have been, I was born in 73. So, you know, when was that? About 81 or something like that, Dog Eat Dog? So I was only a little kid, but I was privy to all this music being so young. Our house was like a youth club, and it was a bit of a place where if kids got thrown out of their homes, they'd come and sleep at our house. So, you know, you'd wake up in the morning and come downstairs and there'd be some 6 foot dude with his Dr. Martens and a massive Mohican asleep on the sofa because their mum and dad had kicked them out.
What did your parents do, Paddy?
They didn't do an awful lot, you know. My dad was unemployed for pretty much most of my life. You know, we grew up on Social Security.
The Thatcher lost generation.
Yeah, all that sort of thing. My mum, I can't remember. I think when I was very little, she might have had jobs, but she was mum. She was at home.
Deciding you wanted to be an actor is pretty rare in a background like that. You know, I was a working-class actor. And, you know, I went to Anna Scher and she encouraged acting amongst those local working class kids in Islington where I grew up. But it was a rare thing to say, to do, you know, to take that chance. It wasn't expected. You were expected to go into, you know, get some employment at 16.
Down the print.
Yeah.
How did it come to you? How did it make...
I just wondered...
Do you imagine that?
I don't know, Gary. I think there's a lot of it's to do with fate, and I'm just a really lucky person in a way, because when I think back to myself as a teenager, I remember a quote from Steve Jones when he's talking about, you know, pop stars and Brian Ferry, you know, because I thought these people fell out of the sky, like Bowie literally fell out on a star. And I'm like, I felt the same. I just thought, how would you ever become a rock star? How would you ever do that? How would you ever become an actor? I had no concept. All I had was this sense that I wanted to get out and escape my beginnings in a way and to transcend it. And that was really inspired by watching, you know, Rocky films as a kid and going, you know, I'm not going to be a boxer. I don't like getting belted in the face, but I want to get out of here. You know, we didn't have the greatest start in life. My old man was in and out of Nick and that when we were kids. And, you know, it's not a sob story, but it was one where I thought, I don't want that life for me. And I don't want that life for any of my potential children. But I wasn't good at anything other than performance. That was the only thing.
Were you a reader?
I loved to read. Yeah, I loved reading, despite struggling with reading quite a lot. I did read books. And I was always a bit of a dreamer, you know. I was always... But I tell you what didn't happen, Gary. my parents never told me, you know, never patronised me. My mum would always say to me, she was a very simple working class lady, and she'd quote the ELO song, she'd say, hold on tight to your dreams. You know, she'd say things like that to me. And that was all we kind of really had. It was the outside world. It was teachers, careers officers, all them kind of people were the people. Like, what are you going to do for a proper job? You know, and I hope it keeps right for you, mate. But I remember leaving school, going to a joinery and working, and I was sanding window frames for a summer. And I was going on to do this drama course that I never completed in the end. But I worked in this workshop full of people, and not one of these people patronized me in any way. Not one of them. And they were always saying, he's going to be an actor. And he's going to be, and their reference was like, you know, EastEnders. And it was like, he's going to be on EastEnders one day. And they'd talk it like that about me. And they'd never seen me act. I wasn't particularly good at acting. But these working class people in this factory weren't going, yeah, mate, good luck. They were going, he's going to be an actor one day. He'll be on telly one day, he will. And I look back now and I find that remarkable.
My brother, when he was 16, he left school. I don't think he'd mind me telling anyone. He got one O-level in woodwork. And he went into the print where my dad was. And he was a compositor, which would have been a redundant job by now. You know, it's where you get the little bits of metal with A, B and C written on and you create the page. And he was training to be one of those. And when I think about a year later, you know, Spandau Ballet are starting to sort of kick off and the record companies are getting interested, but just vaguely. My dad writes a letter to his boss in the print saying, I'm sorry, my son has got to leave the firm because he's going to be a pop star. He actually wrote that in the letter. And the bloke in the firm was just like, yep, yeah, right, lovely, good luck to him. He's going to be a pop star.
Oh, and amazing.
We'll let him go then. And, you know, there was nothing condescending about it whatsoever.
Yeah, but isn't it? Because that's so much of what everyone's looking for is in pop stars and in actors and everything is that thing of someone who got out. And it's either... And you can, people look at that as a beacon in two ways. Either they did it so I can do it too. Or it's like, well, someone did.
Absolutely. Sometimes people tell me, why do you tell your story? Why do you say these things about you exposing too much? And I'm like, well, look, you know, it's what you said there. It's like, you know, it's going to inspire somebody or it's going to make somebody say just that. Well, at least somebody did it.
Yeah.
But that's interesting you say that because I believe it is much harder for working class people to be taken seriously as actors.
It is now. It's certainly now.
There is a lot of class still within the acting fraternity, and especially within, you know, as far as producers and casting directors and directors look at actors, and they want them to be learned and well-read and had a good education. And quite often, most of the very successful ones have come from private schools.
Yeah.
You know, working class actors do tend to end up in soap operas or comedy. Is it harder for you? Has it been harder for you?
I think it is because so much of my early work was formed with Shane. I think my only frustration as an actor is just saying, I can do more than that. I'm not, those films are fantastic. People love them. I will never escape the shadow of Dead Man's Shoes ever.
Yeah.
That's it. But like, for me as an actor, I'm going, I'm capable of so much more. And I somehow need to transcend that. But trying to break out of that mold has been really difficult. And it's not like, oh, I'm aspiring for these roles to sort of, I don't know, you know, change my class in any way. You know, it's just I want the chance to be a king. You know, why can't I play a king in something? What's that all about? Why can I not be considered? And years ago, I got sent a script for this lead role, and the lead role was boring, and I knew I'd have a miserable time, and it would be a dull performance. But King Charles was great. And I went, I don't want to play him, but I'll play King Charles. And the response was, oh, they don't really see you as a king. So that's the kind of shit that you have to deal with. But I would say this to people in general. I worked years ago with an actress called Natalie Prest. I'd never read Shakespeare. And she was talking about Shakespeare, and because we tried to do it at school and it was boring, frankly, she brought it up and I went, oh, Shakespeare, fuck, you don't need fucking Shakespeare, you know, like, who needs that, you know? And she went, oh, well, that's a shame. And I went, why? And she went, because you'd love it, and it's an amazing world, and once you open that treasure chest, it's just wonderful. And then I realised, I went, shit, your ignorance has denied you access to this body of work, you know, to these great plays. And I think working class kids are afraid of that. You know, they're afraid to dive in because it's perceived as being posh or whatever, or you're somehow leaving, you know, your roots. But very, very scared of stepping out of our comfort zones.
But might be a bit of a blind alley, but to Gary's point, there is a generational thing here, because, you know, my dad was an actor, right? I grew up around actors.
Yeah.
And my mum always said, the funny thing, when he started, which was like the early 60s, and everyone, you had to be working class. You had to pretend to be working class. Back then, that was because that was the height of this post-war meritocracy. And actually, all those great actors who seemed posh were all working class. All Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole and
Of course.
And so it was a completely different thing. And ironically, my dad's first regular work was he became a member of the RSC. And he was completely...
You're talking about Terry Stamp and Michael Caine and that kind of crap.
So there is a generational thing. It is to do with this awful, you know, pulling up of the ladder that we've been experiencing over the last...
You know, just remember that, you know, Shakespeare was a grammar school boy. I mean, actually, funny enough, Mark Rylance goes out of his way to try to deny that it was Shakespeare at all.
That
stuff. But
a lot of people do, which I also think is classist. Is that's that thing of the idea? No, it couldn't be him. It must have been this toff.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got so much to bring to that work, given all of your experience and what you've done.
Yeah,
that is Shakespeare something you've not got up on stage and done Shakespeare yet?
No, I only ever did it in a film. Justin Kurzel made a version of Shakespeare. I did a version of Macbeth, and that was the first time I ever did it. And that's the first time I played Banquo.
Oh, you played Banquo?
Yeah, and that's the first time I ever sat with the text and worked with it. You know, and it was quite frightening, really, because I'd made all these sort of, I'd had all these preconceived ideas about how difficult it was and the language and all those barriers. And once you started to break it down, in actual fact, it was great training for when I did House of the Dragon, because, you know, some of that stuff isn't the easiest stuff to say. It was good groundwork for that as well.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Let's talk about one of the musical films you did, which is 24-Hour Party People.
Yeah.
Because you played Rob Gretton, didn't you, the manager? Guy, did you ever bump into Rob Gretton?
He was around my house. I had him around my house once. with Peter Hook.
Well, how do you think Paddy did then?
I think Paddy did very, very well. I don't know. I remember Rob was very worried about getting a cab, and I thought this was really funny for someone who's managed clearly one of the most chaotic bands in the world for like over 20 years at that point. It's like, mate, surely getting a cab... is not a problem for you.
Yeah.
But he was absolutely... No, you did fantastically. My takeaway from that film is one of the posters was of Steve as...
As
Anthony. And it just said Pratt. So I was like, oh, great, thanks a lot.
Or something worse.
No, but that was actually a poster.
Did you meet Rob Gretton?
I think I've got one of those posters somewhere. And I don't know if it says "See you next Tuesday" on it or TWAT on it. I'm not sure.
but did you meet Rob?
I'd never met Rob. No, Rob had passed away before we started the film. So
right, of course he had.
Yeah, I never got to meet him, which was a shame.
Did you meet any of the Manchester lot? Did you have to immerse yourselves properly? Or
Loads of people. You know, met all the New Order. Stephen and Gillian I've met since. I saw Stephen the other week. We were playing a gig in Manchester. And he was with a band called Sea Fever, and some of their members play with New
we'll
Order
get
now.
Get him on, actually. It's someone we want on.
Yeah. Oh, he's great. He's a great guy. So over the years, I've seen him out and about at festivals and things like that, and met Barney years ago a couple of times. But Peter was great. You know, I love Peter. I only met him really briefly, but I'm a big fan of Peter's. I love his bass playing.
Yeah.
He's really great. So... So I met him, Tony. Tony was an interesting one because, well, I'll tell you
Tony
a story.
Wilson.
Yeah, Tony Wilson. We were in
Anthony H. Wilson.
Anthony H. Wilson. Yeah, yeah, please. Yeah. We were in like a set of the Hacienda and they'd rebuilt it. So it wasn't in the actual building, but they'd rebuilt it somewhere else and as a set, but they'd done it perfectly inside. Everything was where it used to be within a set. And I was standing in there and I remember looking over and seeing Leslie Gretton, who's Rob's wife. And I looked at her and she looked at me and I took my glasses off because that was a big thing of Rob's. You know, he wore those big mm-hmm. glasses. And I went, I almost apologized for seeing her. And I took them off and I said, oh, I'll take these off. And she went, no, I'm glad you did that. And we stood there talking. And as we're talking, she goes, do you know that this is the corner that me and Rob used to stand in? And I went, wow. And then you look around the Hacienda and one by one, it was like, oh, and that was where the Happy Mondays used to hang out. And that was where, and everybody, actors, they hadn't been told to stand there. Had gravitated naturally towards the different areas of the Hacienda where their bands would hang out. And I thought that was really, really spooky.
Wow.
That they were just in different points. I remember seeing Bears. I met Rowetta took me over to meet Bears and he went, are you Rob, who are you playing? And I went, oh, I'm playing Rob Gray. And he went, nowhere near, mate. And I went, oh.
And slammed the door.
You know what? I would question Bez's memory of anything, to be honest.
Did you read Hookie's book about the Hacienda?
No, I haven't read it yet.
To anyone, it's beyond any Spinal Tap level of like car crash, everything. It's just extraordinary.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah, I thoroughly recommend it.
Tony wouldn't come near me on set. He wouldn't come anywhere near me. He avoided me. And it got to the point where I felt a bit like, what's the matter with him? You know, like he's talking to all the other cast members or he won't come anywhere near me. And I felt started to feel slightly offended by it. And I think I spoke to his son and I said, you know, your dad won't come anywhere near me. He hadn't spoke to me really. And he says, well, why do you think? And then I realized in that moment that he was actually avoiding me because, you know, he couldn't talk to me when I was in the costume and stuff. But I loved Tony.
I sat next to him. So I'm just one little anecdote. I sat next to him at Bernard Sumner's wedding at the reception. And this was very near the end. And he was really, really unwell. And he was clearly and understandably angry and resentful at how he was. And, you know, and he just turned to me and he said, what do you do? I said, oh, I'm a musician. He went, I hate musicians. That was it.
Perfect. Well, he said this to me. I was sat. We were sitting in Cannes, and he was on about. Oh, I'm starting this new label, and I've got I'm doing bands, and I said, I've got a band, Tony. He goes, how old are you? And I said, I'm 31. He went, you're too old, son. And I went, oh, fair enough. I won't give up just yet, but you know,
my friend John Sim, who plays Bernard in it, he said making that movie was, shall we say, immersive, quite method.
I think it was for some more than others, yeah.
Yeah. quite a lot of hugging entailed, I think.
yeah, there was a bit of that going down. I mean, that's not quite my scene, but there was a lot of that going down. There was a lot of casualties. I was looking around at people like going, You don't look very well. Like, you know, this isn't good. Maybe somebody needs to step in here and have a word with you. But yeah, it was crazy.
But what a film. I mean, I thought
sort of rave apocalypse now, kind of just literally.
Yeah, a rave apocalypse now. That's amazing. Steve was great in it. Steve was brilliant. I remember getting on a coach on it as well and not realizing that they'd brought a load of like real prostitutes on there. And so I got stuck on this coach because I just finished shooting a scene and then everyone was on the coach and I got on with them and I went, hey, and then the coach took off and then it did this massive, you know, circle of whatever. And I was sitting on this coach going, oh shit, hide me. I'm not on here. I cannot be seen to be being on here. This is just.
Yeah. And then your missus called. Then your missus called.
Yeah.
No, it's not a bad time.
Why do you want a coach? Why do you want a coach?
They're all on a coach in it and they're all getting off their heads and there's all sorts of terribly nefarious things going on. And I'm like,
right,
get me off this coach. So when we pulled up at the services to get off, I couldn't get off it quick. And I was like, get me out of here, man. This is not for me.
I mean, someone else you played was Frank Farragut, who's whether or not he was part of Brian Jones's suspicious death or not, it gets looked at in the movie about Brian called Stoned. Stoned is directed by Stephen Woolley.
Yeah.
And Stephen is one of the reasons that I ended up in Spandau Ballet.
Really?
Because, well, Stephen went to my school, and he's 3 years above me, and he'd left early. He loved film so much. I think he left when he was 16. And he became assistant manager at Screen on the Green.
Here we go. I knew it. Shoehorn it in somewhere.
And Stephen phones up. Oh, he tells Steve Dagger, who's a friend of ours.
Yeah.
You've got to go down to the Screen on the Green this night in August because we're going to have the Sex Pistols play. And of course, that's why I end up going to see the Sex Pistols. And forming the band I formed like the week after with Steve Norman.
Yeah.
But you know, so that's my connection with Stephen. But Stephen wrote, I think he wrote Stone, did he? Or he certainly directed it.
I think he did. I've got to really put my hand up and be honest. I don't know if I even saw the finished film. I can't. It was such a long time ago and I can't remember much about it really. So it's a weird one to talk about. I know that Stephen was really sort of... steeped in, he was fascinated with Brian Jones and really wanted to tell that story.
I haven't seen it either, so you know you're in good hands here.
We're in good company.
I do remember seeing it.
I don't watch a lot of things I've done, if I'm honest with you. I don't watch a lot of stuff, so
it's a funny thing. Yeah, it's a funny, but that's quite common with actors, isn't it? Is that you'd ever?
Yeah, because when you mentioned Blitz, I was like, I've never seen it. I've never watched it.
My friend Paul never watches anything he's ever done.
He doesn't want to know. I can understand.
Who was it? The director, Paul Newman, did some chat show with the director of the it was of a film he'd just done, and they said, yes, Paul famously never watches any film he's ever been in. So, and I have said to him, you really should consider watching Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, because it really is a very good film.
Because you're really good in it. It's a bit of a classic, mate. Yeah.
Is that because you said earlier that, you know, your wife had said, oh, you've got to come and see the end of House of Dragons and the Dragon, because you hadn't... I assumed you'd already seen it, but... Is it something that you feel very uncomfortable about watching yourself on screen?
Yeah, it's the experience of making something versus the finished thing. And, I always find it difficult. I have watched stuff in the past and I watched the first couple of episodes of House of the Dragon, you know, very tentatively, but I watched them in chunks and then I watched them at the screenings, the premieres. But then after a couple of episodes, I stopped looking in, you know, and I just looked at some of the stuff that other people were doing in the show, which was great. I can't do it. I just have a terrible, terrible self-esteem issue that I've never been able to quite get over. And so I can't do it. It depresses me for days. And because I just see absolutely terrible, terrible work. And I can't. And I don't say that to everybody who goes, oh, no, mate, you're brilliant. I just, it does something to me. It hits me on such a sort of, and tough, you know, I don't know, a level I'm so vulnerable watching, I can't do it. And I just think I'm a bad actor. And then I get depressed and want to quit and all that kind of nonsense comes in. And I just, you know, so I try and avoid it as much as I can.
Is that being a perfectionist? Is that actually secretly what makes you so good at what you do?
I don't know if I am that good at what I do. I just do it. You know, I've had to do it. I think ultimately underlying everything I do, music, I'm a survivor. I've had to survive, and I don't know what else to do with my life. And music and performance and sometimes directing are the only things that have ever made sense to me. But a lot of it's about survival to me. I just don't want to be exposed, you know, feel exposed like that and just go, I'm a phony or something. You know, it's quite a difficult thing.
Imposter syndrome. We've all got it. We've all got it. It's part of the kit. You know, I think it is.
And you're like, get over yourself, you know.
Well, you know, I felt that about being working with Nick Mason on this band, you know, because a lot of people were very suspicious about me doing that. You're waiting for the hand to come on your shoulder and someone to say, I'm sorry, it's been a terrible mistake. You know, doing the craze, that put my head on the chopping block too. And sometimes you just you know, you've got to just push yourself out. Yeah, there. You've only got one go at this.
Well, it's when we got to Toronto just about a week ago, and and it all comes back, because that's where I first rehearsed with Pink Floyd and everything. And I remember coming in and seeing that stadium and just thinking, you're going home in a week. You're being sent home. Of course you are. There's no, you can't do this.
Yeah, so. It's crazy. I know we do it to ourselves, and it's terrible. But there's a part of me that doesn't want to run away either. So even doing a play or whatever, you're terrified of it. But you're kind of going, if I run away, that's worse. I have to face this thing.
Do you feel that when you watch yourself performing, if you watch videos of yourself performing with Riding the Low,
I don't mind photographs of Riding the Low. I think because people film them on their phones, and our music isn't so massively known. Because I think that if someone takes a shitty, video of a Saucer Full of Secrets gig, well, people are familiar with the music and they can fill in the blanks for the audio sounding so horrific. Whereas people film our gigs and they don't really know our songs massively. And so they think that's what we sound like, and it sounds like shit. So they're not filling in those blanks. So I can't watch it. Like, you do a great gig and the atmosphere has been amazing. And, you know, the relationship with the audience, you know, it's been a great show. You can feel it. And then someone goes, oh, look at this. And they start showing you footage and you're like, it just sounds like you're in a tin can or something. And I'm like, there's no atmosphere. And I'm like, I can't do this, but I don't mind listening to our songs. I love listening to the songs. I love writing the songs, and I love playing live. It's less excruciating, but there's something defiant about Riding the Low, and there's a sense of purpose about it. It gives me a different sense of purpose. So I don't feel the same about it. There's a part of me with Riding the Low that I'm, you know, that kind of, that, what was that film, The Field of Dreams? If you build it, they will come, and all that. I feel like that with Riding the Low. I said, just keep going on your path. Keep doing what you're doing, because the penny will drop and people will turn up.
Tim Burgess helped you really at the beginning, didn't he? Tim Burgess.
Tim's one of the best men out there, because
we love Tim. It's a national treasure.
Yeah.
Especially since
what a guy.
Yeah.
And no kind of like pretense. We were facing a lot of stuff because of me being in a band. There was a lot of suspicion. Oh yeah, mate. That, you know, people messaging in on that dreadful thing called Twitter, saying, you know, failed vanity project and all the rest of it. And I'm like, man, you know, we're just doing our thing. But Tim was never like that. Tim got into it or onto it, and he says, well, do you want to come and play some festivals? So that's what we started doing. And then we supported the Charlatans a couple of times. And over the years, he's had his back. And he's got a great guy that works with him, Tim, a really unsung guy called Nick Fraser, who's a top man. And he's always been out there for us, going to bat for us and getting us gigs and festival slots and things like that. He's the guy that got us on at Bingley. So we've had these really great people along the way who've actually seen the band a few times and gone, okay, I get it. I know what this is now. And it takes a few times, goes sometimes for people to get that it's authentic. Yeah. You know, if I wanted to just play music, I'd get my mates in the garage and we can have a knockabout and do some covers, not a problem. But I wrote Riding the Low songs and I thought they were good enough to take out and present to the world. And I still believe that. So that's what drives it.
How is it for the other guys in the band? Because you clearly have another schedule.
I do have another schedule, and that's always seen as the one that's the most problematic. But they're all like, we're all pretty much middle-aged guys. They've all got jobs. Some are teachers. Some, you know, Dan works in the local guitar shop. Richard and Chris are both teachers. They can't just up and leave their jobs either. It's got to work around everybody.
Paddy, something else you've done really successfully. I mean, I love you, man. I mean, singer, actor. And you go and direct a film which you write, and it is incredible, and rightly wins awards. Tyrannosaur, you did in 2011. I watched it recently, and I messaged you to say how incredible I thought it was. I mean, the two central performances from Peter Mullen and Olivia Colman. Oh, I think it's the best thing she's ever done.
Yeah, yeah.
And why, how you win Oscars for some things, and yet that performance slips the
net. There's one scene she has which is just Wow.
What I wanted to sort of know was how much of that was based on your family life and what you knew as a kid growing up.
Yeah, I think it was it's one of those where it's a kind of stew of everything, really. That so I couldn't specifically pick out one thing and say, this is about my dad, this is about my mom. It was just everything about growing up. And I think, you know, my dad was a very sort of violent man at times and very volatile. And I don't know, you know, my mom, you know, as she got older, she got worse with her health. She ended up having no legs and being blind. She had both her legs amputated. And that's the Tyrannosaur in the film that he talks about. And it's the characters in some way dealing with his guilt. And I think in some ways I was probably dealing with the guilt of my mother through that film, of not feeling like I was probably the best son I could have been. But there's so many things going on in it. There's the young artist, the little artist kid who's in that world, but obviously he's an aspiring, you know, artist in some way. He's got a beautiful nature, but that world drags him in and disfigures him. It's all these people just trying to transcend their boundaries, but the worlds that they're in are pulling them back down again.
And so does that estate reflect the estate that you grew up on?
Sort of, yeah. It does, very visually. It's very much like it. I could do a tour of where I grew up and you would say that looks just like the set from Tyrannosaur, and there were certain events in it, you know, that I based it on. But it's a little bit of everything, really. And I think it's also that thing about judgment, about being judged. I was judged a lot as a little kid because of my father's reputation. The name Considine, it wasn't the best one around town. And, you know, I was having doors shut in my face and not being allowed to hang around with other kids because of my surname. And I hadn't done anything wrong. So I think that there's also that element in there of judgment and how we judge people, how we meet people. And Peter's character makes a massive judgment of Olivia's character in there. He just assesses her and rips her down because of where she thinks she lives and where she's from. But in actual fact, she's dealing with her own hell. And I think part of me wanted to say something about that too, about how we just cast judgments on people.
Mm-mm-mm. I mean, he has to be one of the greatest actors we have.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that.
Was this an emotionally difficult project for you to be involved in? But also, did you feel that same imposter syndrome of you know, if it was your first time as a director, because you must have felt I'm being judged by other actors here on how I direct them.
I never did, Gary. It was just
interesting.
That period of making Tyrannosaur, I wrote that film in a week. That film knew what it wanted to be. It was almost like something was writing through me. I had no filter when I wrote it. There was no editor in my head. I just went. It was pure expression from beginning to end. And that's what the film felt like. That's what the process of it felt like. It felt like nothing could go wrong, even when things did go wrong. Even when a few weeks before I got a call from the producer going, you know, the 1.5 million budget, we've only got half of that now. You know, we're down to £750,000 to make that film. And I went, we're making it. That's it. I don't care. We're making this film. Whatever got in the way of it couldn't stop me from making it. So it was a strange experience, and one that I sometimes experience again as a songwriter and experience as an actor, where things just go into that place of flow and you're on a path and there's nothing going to get in the fucking way of it. Nothing.
As a slightly more general thing, I noticed, because like you know, you have this, the three key players, you have this amazing cast. And one thing that does seem to be common when actors direct films is they always have great casts. Is there a thing about, because an actor is directing it, you're thinking, this is going to be great because they know what I do?
I think so, yeah. I think actors feel quite safe with other actors directing them because we know what it feels like on the other side of it. And, you know, I just wanted somebody in the centre of it that was very, very solid and very trusted and very brilliant. And that was Peter Mullen. And I wanted to build everything around him because he was the first person cast in it. He was the guy. I made a short film called Dog All Together, and Peter was cast in that. So I had him back for Tyrannosaur, and Olivia was in the short as well. when it came to making the feature film, the problem I was coming up with was that Olivia had never done anything like that before, anything. And I remember sitting in like a meeting with producers and then going, so who are you thinking of for the lead, you know, the lead role of Hannah, the female lead? And I went, oh, it's Olivia from The Shore. And there was a silence of like, oh.
Little did they know.
Yeah. And they were like, okay, have you thought about anyone else? I went, no, she's going to do it. How do you know she can do it?
Oh my God,
she's
so good.
And I said, I don't know if she can do it. I said, but I don't care. I said, she's doing it. I just had this sense in me. What I had in Olivia was untapped potential. I just thought, and it was partly down to, as well, seeing Kathy Burke in Gary's Nearby Mouth, you know?
And I thought,
you know, Olivia's pure untapped potential. If I cast another actress in that role, when Peter goes in that shop, they're going to immediately look at her and see the damage. And I didn't want that. I didn't want that. And nobody was familiar with Olivia at that time. So when he goes in that shop to her, when we start to reveal her part of the story, it was a revelation because that's not what people expected her to be dealing with. No, just she didn't know she could go to those depths, but it was my job to take her there and make. And after the first week, she wasn't. It wasn't looking good, I'll be really honest. But wow, when she came back after the first week and we had a little chat, she was a revelation. And the biggest thing was, trust me, these are not your words, they're Hannah's. You know, the characters. You've got to trust me on this process every step of the way of it. And she did. And by the time we got to the last week of shooting, you know, because some of those scenes, I was literally lying at her feet, talking her through emotions, not because she can't do it, but I was just firing her head, you know, getting her to run up and down the stairs and run into the room to get, you know, just in the state for certain scenes, stuff she'd never done before. But it was just pulling it out of her. And then, when it came to the lab, there was this scene, the ultimate scene where Peter comes round and he's found Eddie Marzan. I won't say any more if people haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I think there was a jar of flowers in the middle of the room and I could see her. She'd done this scene, done the moment, I'd left it running and I could see her running out of steam. Being an actor, I know when that happens. And that's when you're supposed to shout, cut. But I went, smash the fucking flowers! And she just got this thing of flowers and smashed them on the floor. And it just created this moment. I didn't have to say anything else to her in that moment because she cracked the code. And by the time she was so steeped in the work that she was there. It was a revelation.
That's how flamenco singers work. They have their mentor, a teacher who will be there shouting and guiding them all the way through a performance.
Yeah.
So it's,
yeah.
Ooh. Yeah.
It's your orchestra.
Nice connection. We have to talk about let's talk about House of the Dragon.
Yeah.
Because oh my God, this has taken over.
I just want to make sure we're not going to alienate your audience that tune in every week like I do to listen to great rock and roll.
I was like, with the amount of prog we cover, I think we are Capes and Dragons are safe. Even though it's not before Game of Thrones, that wasn't my area either.
Your performance as the king, I mean, it's Shakespearean stuff. I mean, I'm assuming, we're up to episode 8 now. We've already warned people this. There might be some spoiler alerts in this.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that was your last breath, that when you finally utter at the end on the death. It's a deathbed scene, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. No more. That was it. Those were his last words to his, you know, his wife.
But the part you did, I mean, Paddy... this isn't blowing smoke. This isn't bullshitting you. This is one of the great television performances of all time. I mean, Shakespearean stuff. I mean, what you did with that character, the way you, the vulnerability you showed, and I mean that scene towards the end when he gathers himself up and he walks down to the throne scene, and he tries to make resolution between these warring families, and yet when you later on you're having your final dinner, and you can see suddenly you realise nothing I can say is going to stop this horror.
No, that's life, isn't it? But that's what I saw in the writing and saw in the character, and like, it's life. You can have this notion of putting your house right, you know, before you pass, and all these beautiful ideas about, you know, the end of your life. But it doesn't work that way. Life isn't like that. You can't control people. You know, it's difficult to influence and control them. And yeah, I think as long as in his mind, he did his best and he did his last duty and he stood at that table and he looked at everybody and basically said, look at me. Just look at me for who I am. Look at me as a father, not as a king. This crown, it weighs you down. It destroys you. It slowly destroys you and eats away at your skin and your bones. And it transforms you into this grotesque thing that he became at the end. And I think his thing was saying, look at what this does to you. This thing that you all fight for. This is all it does. It's caused this destruction. And I think by the time he goes upstairs then and takes his last breath, it's like, I've done all I can. I can do no more. Just please take me away and reunite me with the love of my life. And
he also sets chaos, doesn't
he?
Because he thinks he's talking to his daughter, but he's talking to his wife.
Yeah.
And there's this confusion about the God you're talking about, and she thinks you're talking about her son.
Yes.
And
yes.
You're passing on your blessing for him to be the heir to the throne.
Yeah.
I suppose the important thing is, Paddy, is has it made you a monarchist?
No, it has not.
Well, how much do you get to improvise in those scenes, or are they very strict with the script?
No, to be truthful, you don't. What they did allow to leave in the show in the end was a couple of improvised moments from me, because I was so invested in that character. And I'd shot these scenes earlier on with Sean Brooke, who played my wife. And they were such brilliant scenes. And I watched her go through this, like, you know, they put her through this terribly brutal procedure. And I think it's something that the character never gets over. He never recovers from
putting... She has to have a cesarean, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. I mean, people misunderstood and thought that he sentenced his wife to death and chose his kid. It wasn't that. They were both going to die. But we can save this child if we put her through this procedure. But it's horrific. So for me, I was able to come full circle with the character. I just kept that secret with me of, like, the love for his wife is the thing that's... Because, you know, you talk about, you know, acting and, you know, technique. And I just think for some characters, sometimes you carry a little secret. And that was it for him. He never recovered. So when he got sick, he never asked to be cured. The maesters ran around trying to cure him in all sorts of ways. But he wasn't asking for a cure. He wasn't panicking about that. It's almost like silently he had accepted his fate. So in that final moment, in my mind, all he wanted to do was be reunited with his wife, and who was the love of his life. And I'd asked the writers, is there a concept of an afterlife? Is there an idea of God or any of these things? And I just put it, but it was a choice I just made. I thought when he dies, when he looks up, he sees her and that's his passing. And that was the choice I made. And they kept it in. It was an improvised moment and they kept it in. And I was just really grateful that they did that. So no, it's not an improvised thing. You can't just rock up and improvise on Game of Thrones. You know, there's too much language, but they left in some detailed moments like that. And I was really grateful for that.
You know, there's this brilliant scene when you're coming in at the end and you're to the throne room and you're hobbling in. It's so shocking. And you drop the crown and Matt Smith puts it back on your head and all of that.
Yeah.
These are brilliant symbolic moments.
Yeah, but that was another sort of accident that happened. That was another moment that just happened by accident. So, and again, you know, when it happened, it was such a great moment that I went to the director, Geeta, and I just said, you've got to keep that in. You know, we've got to build that in because it's too good.
Wow.
So it wasn't in the script.
Because I found the character throughout the series, I've got to say, I kept thinking sometimes you're not entirely sure. It's like, is he just incredibly sage and wise and cautious, or is he just being dithery and being played by
this? Yeah, you know? Yeah. So I think he was smarter quite good. Than it's people very thought.
Yeah, exactly. It's just that one. It's like, was. Is he any good?
Yeah. They just wanted
to be. But he was just trying to kind of, he was, you know, de-escalation was his kind of mantra, wasn't
that
it?
That was his thing, yeah. And, yeah. He, you know, in story terms, there'd just been a peaceful king called Jaharis, who was a peacetime king. And that's what he inherited, and that's what he wanted to continue. But, you know, early on, the reactions were, he's weak and, you know, he's boring or whatever. And I'm like, nah, man, he's got a plan. He's a wise guy. And, you know, you'll miss me when I'm dead.
That's the other performance, by the way, that really comes, is Rhys in this is...
Yeah,
is phenomenal as well. You know, it's the
this is what makes everything about
the two of you are these towers of, you know, it's fantastic.
That's what makes everything about this series so good, because I mean, Emma Darcy and Olivia Cooke, I'm obsessed with them. Their performances are beyond. But as actors, to be thrown into this world, and you guys didn't know whether the prequel was going to work, right?
No.
You're thrown into a world where you're talking, it's not Shakespeare, there are dragons and magic in this.
Yeah.
And lots of weird shit. But you have to take it enormously seriously and invest emotionally in it. The level that everyone's pitching at is way up there. It's so strong and so good. How do you come to agree on all of that? How do you come to get to believe in it?
You've got to set the tone. And when I said before in interviews that I took playing the king very seriously, I really meant it. You've got to go in there and be a good example and set a sort of, you know, this isn't all on me, but I'm just saying I had to take this very, very seriously. I was mm-hmm. the king, and this, for whatever relevance it said, you were number one on the call sheet, right? You know what that means. And it's like, I've got to set some sort of standard for myself only. And that's all that really happened. We just went in with a certain standard, and I had a certain standard. And I always thought that it was a great part. I never didn't think that he was a great part. When I read it, I thought someone's passed this. Someone else has had this and passed on it. They didn't. It was for me. It was sent to me. They only considered me. And when I read it, I was like, I don't care if this guy's the king of the fucking Smurfs. I don't care. it's a great role. And I thought he was a gift. And I'm like, I love him. And I've just got one job to do, go there and make this as believable as I possibly can.
What is it like when you're there on set? Because when you see it on TV, it's fucking unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, is there a lot of blue and green screens hanging everywhere? Are you...
There wasn't for me, no. I was very much stuck in the Red Keep, you know, sat on my arse for most of it.
Where is that? Where is the Red Keep? Where physically in the world?
At Leavesden. So we were just there all the time. We were at in Watford all the time. Well, I was. So
now you've ruined it for me now. It's never going to be the same, mate.
So like, I never got to do any of that kind of stuff, but without spoiling the illusion of it, really, you know, you can have all the dragons you want, but if the drama doesn't work on a humanistic level, then what's the point? Yeah. You know, but the show's worked because, you know, you're sitting there in these junkets earlier on and you say, no, it's a family drama, and it sounds like some bullshit buzzword that you've... you know, something you've been given by HBO to say to people who are interviewing you. But the truth is, it is a family drama. And people are going to watch it, and they're going to identify with certain aspects of it. The response I got after the last episode was how many people had nursed their parents and loved ones in the last days of their life and seen, you know.
That absolutely reminded me of the death of my parents. Mm-hmm. Your performance on the deathbed is just breathtaking. Paddy, it's just so amazing having you on, and don't ever feel that you're not as worthy as Noddy Holder. Guys, did you want to say something?
The one thing that struck me about the whole that, and I'm just wondering, it's just a little personal thought, which is the reason I thought about the Game of Thrones and House of Dragon is because what it is, it seems to me, because we haven't had this sort of telly or film for a long time, but is that in the 70s, it's exactly the sort of thing people wanted to make in the 70s. But this is like with all the sex and violence they would have wanted but couldn't do.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. There's always a bit of Caligula thrown in there at certain points.
What's next, Paddy?
Well, you know, we've got, you know, as far as Riding the Lower concerned, we've got a new single coming out in November. And we've got a show in a couple of weeks in Derby that we managed to sell out, which was great. And then, you know, we're going to go and make the next album. We've got management now because everything we've done so far, we've done on our own. And, you know, with help from people like Tim, of course, and Nick. But, you know, it's pretty much us doing the work as it is. But, like, we've got management now, hoping that next year we've got some festivals already. So that's what we're really doing, acting-wise. Yeah. I haven't got a job at the minute, so...
It's tricky.
Resting, isn't it?
I'm like Yossi Hughes. You remember Yossi Hughes? Gets a job.
Yeah,
remember him?
From Boy, yeah.
It's tricky. Do you think it's tricky in the UK? being taken seriously when as an actor and as a musician. There's always this kind of thing, well, you can only really have one job, you know. I've suffered that slightly, you know. Well, I have suffered it, you know. He's not really an actor, he's a musician.
You do all right, you seem to do fine.
No, but there is this, it's tricky, and my agent will tell you. But if you go to America, they seem to be more embracing of
they do. They're not so much like, you know, there's that mentality in England of like, stay in your lane. Mm-hmm. Stick to what you're good at. And, writing music to me seems as natural as it does acting in House of the Dragon. It's just part of what I do, you know.
Paddy Considine, the artist. We are happy to have had you on, mate. You're a special person.
It was a joy. It's a long one. That's always the good sign. That's the sign.
Well, I hope it does all right. I hope this makes number one. I'd be chuffed with that.
Yeah, there you go. It's been really, really brilliant, Paddy. Really great talking to you.
Mate, really looked forward to it, and so great to see you both. Yeah, brilliant.
Okay, we've got to go, haven't we, guys?
We have got to go. We've got to go to Church Studios, as we just said. But that was fantastic. It was brilliant. What a lovely, refreshing man to talk to, and, you know, as relevant to this as anyone.
Do you think I'll get any birthday cake today?
Oh, God, I meant to say that it was your birthday. Paddy.
I think you I did at the beginning.
No, I did, but I didn't. You didn't say it to Paddy. I didn't say it to Paddy. But then, no.
I feel a little bit upset about that, but never mind. what I'm hoping on is a nice piece of cake with you later. Have you Have you got your?
I am. It's been a nightmare in here. And of course, with 110 volts, it takes forever for water to boil.
Anyway, I want to thank Ben Jones, our producer, Gimme Sugar, and we've got one more while we're away, I think. One or two more.
We're going to keep at it for you people. That's what we do.
We are. And thank you for listening. It's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.